The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. Timothy Tennant. More information is available at www.biblicaltraining.org.
Now, the eighth lecture is where we explore the doctrine of tradition, the role of tradition in Islam, and hopefully more of the pieces will begin to come together, because revelation is a huge issue when you talk to Muslims. Our next great Quranic passage, number 9, is found in Surah 2, Ayah 151. This is, again, this important Surah 2, known as the Cow. Muslims and Hindus believe in the sacredness of the cow. So here we are, the cow. That was a joke, but... wasn't a very good one. Surah 2, Ayah 151 is a really important passage because this is the passage which they quote as giving them the expanded view of revelation that extends beyond the Quran. We have, at this point, we've only really, if we talk about revelation in Islam, the only thing we've really discussed up to this point is the Quran, the 114 surahs. What we will hopefully clearly exposit as time develops is that this is only in practice one component of several that make up the doctrine of Islamic revelation, and more importantly, for practical purposes, feed into the Sharia, which is the Islamic law. The Islamic law is drawn from three sources, one of which is the Quran. The second one we're now putting into place, this is the Hadith. So we're now beginning to construct a proper view of how Muslims actually view revelation. And it is based on this particular passage in Surah 2, 151. Therefore, this is one of the great Quranic passages where it says, thus... we, again, this is the majestic plural, this is Allah speaking, thus we have sent forth to you an apostle of our own. Who is that? Muhammad, of course. Who will recite to you, what does the word recite come from? Quran is the word recite. Okay, so he is going to Quran for you, recite for you, our revelation and purify you of sin. Now listen to this phrase here, this is an important one. Who will instruct you in the book and in wisdom. The language there is, the reference there is the, referred to the book is a reference to the Quran, and they believe this reference to wisdom is a reference to the Hadith. So that becomes very important. On one hand, you have the clear belief that the Quran is without error, it's inerrant. We discussed, I think, this earlier, Surah 39:28. The Quran is free from all faults. The Quran is a transcript of the heavenly book, Surah 43:1, etc., etc. But now we have this, this second whole revelation that's mentioned here, known as the Hadith or tradition. And this is where we have to explain how this comes about. The Quran, while certainly the major source, and most Christians, if you were to talk to Christians on this campus and ask them about Muslim view of revelation, they would, of course, have heard of the Quran. They probably may not have heard of the Hadith. And so it raises the whole question, how important is it, and what is the relationship of the Hadith to the Quran? Well, the Quran obviously has a primary source of authority for Muslims. But let's be honest. Hopefully by now you've read enough of the Quran to know that the Quran is seriously lacking in a lot of areas in terms of communal guidance. The Quran retells a lot of Old Testament stories. You have Muhammad defending himself at several points. A lot of repetition. A lot of themes are repeated. If you take out all the repetition, the Quran is significantly narrowed in its scope. So when you actually look at how much information is in the Quran that would actually guide the community, you have to ask yourself, where is the personal ethics structure in the Quran? Think about it. Is there a lot, if you really go through the Quran and talk about and read it just as a book of ethics, personal ethics, what do you come out with in the Quran? How about commercial activity? How do you conduct your business affairs? Social conduct, it is a bit stronger in the area of social conduct. There are some regulations about men and women in the Quran in some way. But there are certainly issues that the Quran does not codify. So the question arose, how is a true Muslim to behave in a particular situation in which it is not specifically addressed in the Quran? What do we do? Is there any wisdom for us outside of the Quran? And of course, this text is quoted that Muhammad will instruct you in the book and in wisdom. Now, this is going to be interpreted to mean that Muhammad's life becomes a source of information and guidance, and yes, let's just say it, revelation for the Muslim community. Now, you've got to see how radical this is. You've got to say back to me, I can't believe it. There we go. Because this should not happen. I mean, Muhammad has viewed himself as a channel. He is a passive channel. He is merely being dictated from Gabriel what Allah is saying. Muhammad has never put himself forward as a source of revelation. You might, if you say there is no God but Allah, Muhammad is the prophet of Allah, all that tells you is that Allah is a spokesman for Allah. If you say, you know, Isaiah is a prophet, we acknowledging that Isaiah is receiving revelation from God. We all accept that. But does that mean that we would now say, therefore Isaiah can become a source of revelation? So if Isaiah ate a certain kind of food, that becomes important for us? No, we don't care about things like that. We separate Isaiah as a channel or as a recipient of revelation, which he gives to us through the word, and Isaiah as a source of revelation. So this develops in what is known through interesting coincidence of words, the word sunnah once again. Of course, sunnah means what is normative, which also, another translation is what is customary. You see, the word has a very similar meaning there. The custom or the normative practice of Muhammad, the practice of Muhammad. So the Arabs in pre-Islamic Arabia, they already had a concept of sunnah. It meant, the customs of your forefathers. What was the normative practice of your forefathers? How did your forefathers do things? And precedent was very, very important in the pre-Islamic world. And mainly, this custom was passed down orally. This was an oral tradition. This is very typical of the ancient world. Certain practices, they would say, well, we know this was done because my father told me this is the way our grandparents did it. This is the way our forefathers did it. It's all passed down orally. So the adherence to custom or sunnah as a source of guidance definitely predates the advent of Islam. So there is a big precedent for this. But applied to the Islamic context after 632, this is a huge development theologically. This is in the year 11 AH, 11 years after the Hijra, 632. Customs begin to be handed down. People say, well, Muhammad said this. Muhammad said that. And people have said, the Quran doesn't address X. It doesn't address what we should do here, how to do that. Or people ask the question, for example, when you pray in the when you go before to the mosque, we know the Quran says to wash your hands. It says wash your hands to the elbow and wash your feet to the ankles and all that. We looked at that text in this class in the whole cleansing thing. But it doesn't tell you which hand to start with. Do you start with left hand or right hand? And someone said, well, I know that Muhammad, when I saw him pray, and I saw him go through the cleansing. And whenever Muhammad did that, he started with the right hand or whatever, And that therefore these things begin to be put
into the oral tradition, how Muhammad did everything. So what eventually happens is the Sunnah is the oral tradition. These are oral stories that eventually became little vignettes, little anecdotes, like we do to this day. You know, what people say, you know, oh, do you know Harold Achengay did this or Harold Achengay did that? We have this. Or George Washington cutting down the cherry tree. He said this to his father, I cannot lie. Da-da, you know, and supposedly that whole thing is a lie that happened, but I don't know. These stories are passed down. So what happens eventually is that the Sunnah, the oral tradition of the customs or normative practice of Muhammad, get codified into written form, little pericopes is what we would say. Little defined story or defined bit of material, bit of data which describes what Muhammad did, a little narrative as it were. And once a sunnah is written down, it becomes known as hadith. This is the avenue from a oral tradition to written down, is the path from sunnah to hadith. Now, if you look on your handout, lecture number 8, you'll see that our general heading here is hadith as a source of Islamic revelation. It begins with sunnah, which is a short narrative oral tradition. Make sure you keep that clear in your mind. The sunnah is always oral. The moment it's written down, it becomes hadith. Now, and I have a little chart on the bottom that maybe will help you sort some of this out, but essentially, the hadith is divided into various kinds of categories. One is the hadith Qudsi, other hadith Sharif. Hadith Qudsi is when Muhammad spoke or acted under divine inspiration as an actual representative of Allah. Now, if you accept Hadith Qudsi, that means you are clearly identifying Muhammad as a source of revelation where God, Allah, is using the actions or the comments of Muhammad to convey further revelation that did not appear in the 114 surahs. The Hadith Sharif means noble hadith, and this means the Prophet's actions and utterances regarding everyday conduct down to many minute details, even things like how Muhammad precisely tied his sandals, that is considered to be obligatory or actually not obligatory, but informative, worthy of guidance, and good for the historical record. So you have that general development of hadith. But then you have a further division between what is considered merely obligatory, or what is certainly obligatory, and what was merely edification or for guidance, but not obligatory. So they begin to divide up the hadith into various kinds of categories to basically organize, okay, number one, what did Muhammad say? Can we verify that he actually said it? That's something we'll look at in a moment. But then once we verify what he said, then we have to begin to decide, well, is this something that is binding on every Muslim everywhere? Or is this something that is just worthy of emulation, but it's not required or mandated? Or something which is just good to know about, interesting, helpful, maybe inspirational, but is not really part of Muslim practice? So that's essentially what happens. The hadith begins to develop as a way of guiding the community on two levels. Guiding the community in a revelatory way, where new revelation is now emerging outside of the 114 surahs, and other information which is for guidance of the community, which may not be considered revelatory. There are many other texts that talk about wisdom or hadith. I won't go into all of those, but essentially, you can imagine as the Islamic community grew and developed, then it became quite tempting. If you had a particular group that had a particular question in hand, and there was no ready answer in the Quran to invent a hadith to provide the guidance you needed. And so what happened was, and this is, by the way, this is not a scandalizing statement, I'm telling you. Muslims themselves acknowledge that in the early days, hadiths were invented to support various positions. So this is where you finally get, as Christians often ask me, you know, what about textual criticism in Islam? Because they know the, you know, they Uthman burned all the variants and the Quran is unassailable and all that. And they say, do Muslims even have textual criticism? Well, in fact, they do have a huge school of textual criticism. The problem is it just doesn't work on the Quran. It works on the hadith. So this is where that whole side of what we would call textual criticism emerges in the Muslim community, and that is analyzing the hadiths and determining which of these is authentic and which of these is not authentic. So for a while there, the supply of hadiths always seemed to meet the demand. So you have, and this is no joke, I mean, this is not a stretch. This is a matter of the record. Now, you had legal maxims, Jewish and Christian material that suddenly finds itself in the mouth of Muhammad. You have aphorisms from Greek philosophy that suddenly emerge from Muhammad's mouth. And so eventually, students of the Hadith were openly embarrassed about just flat-out contradictions in the Hadith, and the fact that the Hadith often clearly had a source which had no connection whatsoever to Muhammad historically. So they believed, the Muslims themselves believed, that the tradition of Islam was being invaded by forgeries on a vast scale, sometimes by editing genuine tradition, sometimes by supplanting completely foreign material and inventing material into it. So the result is the development of Isnad. Isnad is very, very important. This is the way the Muslims control and verify a genuine hadith from a spurious forgery, invention, or alteration of some kind. So what happened is, if you have a hadith which is a written narrative, which records something the Prophet said or did, so it records the sunnah or the example of the Prophet. In order for this to be accepted, you must include with the hadith the isnad, which is the chain of transmission. That's what isnad means. Isnad means the chain of transmission or the chain of transmitters. It's like your pedigree, where you trace the source of the hadith back to the original companions of the Prophet. So, for example, a very important one would be a typical well-attested hadith would be, you know, Aisha, that's source A. You know, Muhammad told Aisha, his favorite wife, this hadith. She told it to B, who then told it to C. And so you have a tracing. Here's the hadith, and the character of these is well established. And so you have a link from Muhammad to the written hadith. So you're verifying the oral tradition, the sunnah. And we'll explain in a minute how they verified this in a moment, because this is where the whole textual criticism comes into play, is in the isnad. The way they determine the reliability of the chain of authority is through two main considerations. One is the character of the transmitter, and the other is the closeness of the transmitter to Muhammad. So, can we trust C? If C has a great reputation in the Muslim community, he says, listen, Abu Bakr told me this. Okay, if you are a well-received person with a great reputation, you've been faithful to the Muslim community, and you say, Abu Bakr told me this, And Abu Bakr, of course, is the right. He cannot be contradicted. He's the caliph. And he says Muhammad said this, or he saw Muhammad do this, then that is an isnad that's unassailable. This is the idea behind this. So what they did, and you'll see on the handout here, three terms to describe different kinds of isnad, only two of which, as you'll see in the chart below, are significant for the ongoing work of this. And you can just give the translation beside each of the words. Sahih means sound tradition. Sahih hadith, sound tradition. Hasan hadith is good tradition. Daif hadith is weak tradition. So these words refer to sound, good, or weak. Now, what constitutes each of these? A sound tradition means that the isnad is carried back to the prophet without any interruption. It has to go back to an immediate companion of the prophet. And every person in the isnad is a person of sound character and eventually goes back to immediate companion, which satisfies the closeness criteria. Hasan, and this is important to note what this means. If you have A, B, C, D. Okay, we'll say you have a four-link isnad. All right. The first kind, the sahih, the sound tradition, there can be no breaks in this link. All right. In the second kind, the hasan, you can have one weak link, but please hear the whole thing before you write this down, because this is a point of some confusion. You cannot have a weak link and just has a weak link, and that becomes a good, they allow like one exception. Because obviously, if you have a one weak link in a chain, that throws the whole thing off. But they allow one weak link if that link can be verified through another hadith, another isnad. So, for example, if you have A told B this, B told C this, C told D this, and the C is a weak link. But you have another hadith over here that's G, H, I, and J. And the G and H is weak, and I and J is weak. But by George, the H and I is a very strong link. This can be determined. And this actually is the same hadith as this one. And by the way, there's tons of repetition in these hadiths. But if you can verify it through another isnad, which may have all kinds of other problems, but that particular link is a sound one, then this link can help shore up a one link, no more than that, but one weak link. So you can imagine how all this flows into the whole textual criticism thing, because you're actually spending a ton of time verifying these links to prove the particular hadith that is there. You can see on the chart here that the hadith, now this whole chart is dealing with different kinds of what happens to the hadith that are verified as sound hadith or as the good hadith with the other tradition that supports the one weak link. The da'if over here is just out of the picture. It's just rejected as a weak link. You can see that both the sahih and the hasan, once you get into that category, this is considered an authentic hadith. Muhammad actually said this or he actually did this. And that is divided into three general categories. What Muhammad did, the example of Muhammad, they call that the sunat el-fa'il, the example of Muhammad. The precept of Muhammad, what Muhammad said, is probably more literally the sunat el-qayul, what he said, and then what he allowed, the sunat et-taqrir, the license or the allowance. So, this begins to categorize the hadith into different categories of something Muhammad did, said, or permitted. We saw Muhammad do this thing. He didn't say a word, but we watched him do this, and that becomes a whole bunch of hadiths like that. Or he commanded this, or he permitted this. And then once you establish whether it's something he did, commanded, or allowed, then you go back to my original distinction between sacred and noble, whether or not it's something that is binding on the community or whether it is non-binding or non-obligatory on the community. So it's a pretty elaborate structure here in order to determine the hadith and how it works. Now, let me give you some examples. According to the Ali tradition, the Shia tradition, they say Muhammad, they have approved, verified isna that said Muhammad said these words. Muhammad sent Abu Bakr to read to the people and says, let angel Gabriel give it to Ali to read. Do not let it be performed by anyone other than you or someone from your family or your behalf. All right, so this whole link. Muhammad supposedly said, O Allah, be thou the supporter of whoever supports Ali. Now, if Muhammad said, be thou the supporter, Allah, of whoever supports Ali, that's obviously very important, is not, to verify. So what happened is that you have collections of hadith, but they largely break down over sectarian lines. So the Sunni tradition accepts six major collections of hadith, are considered to be accepted major collections of hadith. The Shia tradition accepts five traditions of hadith. These are different collections altogether. The oldest and most important of all of these is the one by al-Bukhari. That is a work divided into 97 books, 3,450 chapters, 7,300 hadiths. Tell you everything from how Muhammad prayed to how he used the bathroom. I mean, really, everything imaginable. Where he used the bathroom, where he ate, what he ate, when he ate it, how he ate it, what direction he looked when he prayed or didn't pray. Every conceivable thing, Muhammad's life is mapped out in the hadith and is, I mean, again, a lot of these which come across as trivial, you may think. It doesn't mean, that's why this structure is so important, because they can verify Muhammad definitely handled his toiletry in a certain way, does not mean that every Muslim's commanded to do that. It's just that it's a verifiable thing, and therefore anything Muhammad did is subject to hadith. So you have to be careful to recognize how that operates. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's commanded. It's just something that Muhammad did. And therefore, could be inspirational.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 28428, Spokane, Washington, 99228, USA.